Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Good morning, y'all.
Good morning, Nia.
Good morning.
How are y'all today?
I'm good, thank you.
I'm very good.
Yay! Okay, so listeners, once again, I'm not speaking to Augie clearly alone, since you've heard a second voice. That would be Bill Newman. And I also don't use y'all referring to one person because I'm from the South and I understand what y'all means. So, which she said bitterly because she watches movies all the time and points that out. You know that's not singular, right? So anyway, we've invited Bill Newman back because he's been to all the presidential libraries on the earth and more or less, give or take. And we have questions about going to a presidential library. So thank you so much for coming today, Bill, and answering those.
Oh, thank you for bringing me in.
So Bill, how many presidential libraries have you been to?
Okay. I got to run through the
Oh, you knew this question was coming. Come on, dude.
I never count. Someone tally this up. Okay, Eisenhower, okay. Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Clinton. So what do you got there?
Nine. Wow. How many are there total?
Who are you missing? There are the National Archives libraries, and then there are all the other libraries, which have documents, but they aren't necessarily formally in the National Archives system. So the National Archives system, I guess it starts with Hoover.
Okay.
Not sure what's happening with Trump or how that's going to work, because it's still too early in the process and they're sort of negotiating that. Wilson's is in Stanton. Virginia, close by, about an hour and a half away.
Oh, okay. So I can go to one pretty easily. Can I go to one? Can regular humans go to the library, or do you have to be doing big, giant-y, researchy things?
Anybody can go. Yeah, anybody can go. It's great. And when I'm there doing the kind of research that I like to do, there are people who come in and say, my grandfather met Lyndon Johnson in 1966, and I know there was a picture of him with the president, and I don't have it, but it's got to be somewhere in the library. And the archivist will say, okay, well, let's track that down.
That's wonderful. I mean, that's a really cool use of that, of presidential library. I'm not saying that what you use them for is not cool. Sorry, that didn't come out right. Okay, that was a goofball moment. Sorry about that.
Hey, there's something useful about presidential libraries besides all that stuff that you do.
So first of all, does it cost money to go to a presidential library?
No, not at all. It's to go into the museum, you pay a regular museum fee, but if you want to do research, that's no cost at all. All that information belongs to we, the taxpayers.
So are those buildings together, are most presidential libraries in a bigger building that's got the museum and the presidential library and whatever, or are they separate entities within a larger complex?
Most of them are together. The exceptions, the Ford Library, the library is on the campus of the University of Michigan, and the museum is in Grand Rapids.
A bit distant.
Yeah, so which was disappointing to me because I wanted to get like a Gerald Ford t-shirt and live, I don't know, 2.5 hours or so. So I couldn't do that. And Obama's also doing it differently in that he's having his, I guess, a center or a foundation, and then all his actual records are going to be at the National Archives.
Now, Bill,
okay.
Nia talked about the user experience. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about who pays for these libraries to be built, and then to hire the staff to go ahead and organize the materials help out researchers and the public. Mm-hmm. I mean, because does Congress allocate money for this, or do the presidents or their supporters have to go ahead and fundraise for the creation of these libraries?
So the creation of building and things like that, you actually have private foundations that do that. But the materials are organized and managed and maintained by people from the National Archives.
Okay, so you know and that's by federal law, right? Mm-hmm. There are laws that actually regulate what presidents can do with their materials once they leave office.
Right, and while they're still in office.
Yeah, there you go.
So you write a memo, and that after you finish writing that memo belongs to the American public. And so you don't throw it away, you don't delete the email, this is part of the record, that's it. So
you send an email to the chief of staff saying, you know that flunky who just dropped off papers into my office and they copped an attitude, I want them fired. That goes as part of the record in the National Archives.
What things do constitute part of the record? In seriousness, like if you send your secretary an email saying, so for lunch, I want a turkey sandwich and I want a, Diet Pepsi. And then, not that we promote Diet Pepsi, but anyway, Diet Coke, right? Diet Coke was President Trump's, I think, button on his desk, bring me a Diet Coke. But anyway, I assume things like that are not considered part of the presidential. Okay, wait, let me back up. Mm-hmm. At the library, we have what's called the presidential papers, mm-hmm. but they seem to be sort of the official, when I glance through them, and I will admit I have never read any full volume of any of the president's papers, but we have them back to Hoover in print and bound. I'm assuming that when they mean that, they just mean things like official memorandum and sort of speech, texts from speeches and proclamations and that sort of thing. They don't actually mean your lunch order from Papa John's, right? Like they're not, or do they mean that in the presidential library?
So there are different things. So you mentioned the presidential papers that are in the library. So those are the public papers of the president.
Yeah, we have those. At VCU.
It's all the public stuff.
Right.
At the library, you have basically the documentary record of what the president and everyone else in the executive branch, well, certain parts of the executive branch are doing, right, the time. So right now, my guess is if you are an official, and in particular, if you're an official who's appointed by the Senate, so you're a line officer, but even if you're a staff officer with, you've got assistant to the president for X, Y, and Z. Right now, if you send an email that's saying, here's what I want for lunch, that doesn't get deleted as far as I can tell right now. I have in the only administration that I've done research on where there's a big email record is the Clinton administration. And I found, what you get is imagine a printout of all the email. that you read.
Can I just say that would be terrible?
Yeah.
Like, because imagine the gossip that's in there and the personal.
It's hysterical. So when I was at the Clinton Library, I'm sitting there reading, and of course there's an archivist, sitting at the table on the other side of the room watching everything that I'm doing because of making sure that I'm not destroying any records or ruining anything or folding the pages wrong or things like that. There's all these procedures there. And at times I just burst out laughing and looking at me, and I'm like, do you want me to tell you? And a couple of times it's like, yeah, what did you see? So I go up and I say, come here. And they come over and I show them, and I said, okay, so what is that about? And I said, oh, you got to go to like three pages down and you'll see what they're referring to. And they're saying unflattering things about senators or members of the House of Representatives. And it's there.
So that's email. Right. But I'm assuming in the days before email, I know, listeners, there were actually days before email for the younger listeners in the crowd. So Would that have included notes and memos and post-its and that sort of things that just were hanging around? So you didn't get rid of any piece of paper.
You're not supposed to get rid of any piece of paper. Now, I assume that lunch orders and things like that, you know, people just go, okay, that's fine. We can get rid of that. But occasionally that kind of stuff gets in there. Doodles get in there, right? You've got the legal pad and you're taking notes, minutes of a meeting. And then there are, you know, doodles like in the side of the page. Colin Powell did great doodles during National Security Council meetings when he was National Security Advisor. And I always thought it was interesting, and this is the Reagan administration, I'm going through the documents and I'm going through Powell's minutes of NSC meetings, and they're phenomenal. You just see how brilliant the guy was when you look at the minutes and how he's explaining things and how just the sophistication of the arguments that he's presenting. And then you got to the point where the 1988 election happened, right? And now he's the lame duck on all this stuff. And then it just turns into lots of doodles and drawings. And it's just like, I'm ready, so ready to be out of here. And you know, and so that's all in these legal pads. I'm looking at the actual legal pad, and there's a picture of a boat. And there are a lot of 3D boxes and things.
So that's awesome. I would hate to see what my notes would look like if I were in one of those meetings. But I do have a question about redaction. So let's just pretend that in that meeting with Colin Powell and a bunch of other people, somebody's phone number got mentioned to the group, and he noted it on the piece of paper to try to, like, that's who we should call for, I don't know, whatever reason, some innocuous reason. I'm not talking about phone numbers for hookers, although I feel certain that those are somewhere in the records for some people.
Definitely.
But how, are they redacted? Okay, so they're not. So people's private information who aren't in the government, how is that handled when it's part of the governmental record?
Okay, so there's several laws related to all this and how they work it. So you've got, for the stuff that I deal with, so I usually deal with classified stuff or information that was classified, and it's classified for 25 years, unless someone wants to declassify it earlier. But the idea is there would be an automatic declassification of everything after 25 years, except in a series of categories. And actually, preparing for this, I finally learned what the categories are, because I remember doing research. And you'll see, right? You'll see a piece of paper, a printout, or a memo, and there'll be a part of it that's either blacked out or it's just, it's whited out. It's just gone. And what you'll see is like a little number next to it that'll say 25X1 or 25X4, and there are nine exemption from declassification categories. So now I actually know what those things mean. So next time I go to the library, I can say, that's why they're keeping this classified, which is interesting because it tells me something about what that information is.
Yeah, what are the
categories?
Bill, are you talking about the exemptions listed in the Freedom of Information Act?
These are, they're part of Executive Order 13526.
Who was, in that executive order was issued by which president?
This is Obama's, 2009.
Oh, okay. All right. And does that executive order list the law or the section of the Constitution that it's based on?
It is. I've got it right here. Title 44, U.S. Code Title 44, Chapter 21 and Chapter 22.
Title 44, you said.
Mm-hmm. Public printing documents. And then NARA is Chapter 21 and Presidential Records is Chapter 22.
And the executive order is 13526?
Yes. Is that what I just said? Yes.
Sorry. The only reason I'm asking is because we'll link that on the research guide so that people can look at it if they would like to look at it. But I'm curious to know what the nine categories are.
They make sense, right? revealing the identity of a confidential human source, human intelligence source, relational relationship with intelligence or security service, right? Something like that. Revealing information that would assist in the development, production, or use of weapons of mass destruction.
Here's the plans for an atomic bomb.
Yeah, we probably want to
feel free to download.
Keep this confidential, right?
Feel free to download and use at will.
You can only do that on the internet, but not in presidential records. Information that would impair U.S. cryptologic systems or activities. Information that would impair the application of state-of-the-art technology with a U.S. weapon system. Reveal formally named or numbered U.S. military war plans that remain in effect. And here's where it starts to get interesting. Reveal information, including foreign government information. So most of the stuff that I find that's still classified is because it has to do with U.S. ties to another country.
Oh, I see.
Which are
we got going. This information from Israel. We got this information from the UK.
Right.
And we don't want people on the other side to know that they know.
Well, Nia, think about, right? For instance, some of the critiques of President Trump's press conferences or tweets, where it looked like he was telling the world where the United States got intelligence in regards to what, you know, the Iranians were doing, the Chinese were doing, et cetera, et cetera.
At one point, he confirmed we got information from Israel. And
yeah, right?
Arms started to flail because I'm like, we don't confirm where we get anything. Like, you just put Israeli spies in danger because...
Right.
Now somebody knows who to be looking for, right? Like,
and if we can't keep a secret, then those other countries aren't going to want to go ahead and disclose their intelligence to us, which means right. Our job at collecting intelligence for U.S. national security purposes got that much tougher, right? Mm-hmm. That much more difficult.
Right.
Yeah.
We neither confirm nor deny that there are other countries in the world and that we talk to.
Right.
That's what we should be saying.
And some of it is that we may have automatic declassification after 25 years, but another country may have automatic declassification after 35 years.
Okay.
And the conversation that I would like to see is between someone from the United States and someone from that other government.
Okay.
So,
got a couple more.
We've got reveal information that would seriously impair current national security emergency preparedness plans or current vulnerabilities of systems, installations, or infrastructure. So they're all pretty.
Here's how you break into our nuclear plants.
Yeah.
Or here's where our electrical grid is deficient or weak or vulnerable.
Feel free to knock down that part. Yeah, okay.
And the last one is violate a statute, treaty, or international agreement that does not permit the automatic or unilateral declassification of information at 25 years. So there's that. We're working with another government or another institution that says we keep this stuff classified for longer.
But the critique here, Bill, is, and this is a critique that's often made of government agencies using the exemptions in the Freedom of Information Act. Mm-hmm. Do presidents over rely on these exemptions, okay? Because, you know, that's one of the critiques of FOIA, right? You know, the exemptions are overused by federal agencies. Do White Houses do the same thing, okay? Particularly with potentially embarrassing information?
I can go only with the national security stuff, so I don't know what happens on the domestic
side, yeah.
But in the national security stuff, I found that it depends on the president. Depends on the administration.
Okay, so give us an example of a president who was quite willing to disclose warts and all.
Clinton
really?
Was, when he left office, they actually went through particularly information on Bosnia and even Rwanda, which you could say, boy, there are a lot of warts related to U.S. policy in Rwanda. And the Clinton administration went through that stuff and they started declassifying everything that they could very quickly. So you have things from the Clinton administration where you've got a fantastic documentary record right now, whereas the Reagan administration, you're still waiting for this stuff to be declassified. So I put in about, I guess, over 1,000 mandatory declassification requests for the Reagan administration. And the response I got back from them is that, yeah, we'll probably have an answer for you for all of these in 11 years. What they gave me, which is why there's no Reagan case study in the book that I just wrote.
Well, I mean, that's going to be next decade that you write that. Like,
I mean, but that's funny because in an upcoming podcast episode that we'll be posting, we focused on the Tower Commission as part of the Iran-Contra affair, right? And one of the huge criticisms of the Tower Commission was, first of all, they had very limited ability to compel people to provide testimony and evidence, but also the Reagan administration just didn't want to turn stuff over, right? Yeah. I mean, they openly were like, yeah, that's classified. We can't go, we can't tell you, right? Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay, yeah. I'm sorry, Nia, you had a point.
No, I actually had a question. So, all right, I know this is gonna sound convoluted, but I think if I were a listener, and I am a listener, this is what I would want to know, which is, so you get there and you're looking through documents and it's clear that something's missing, right? It's clear that either it's redacted within an inch of its existence and you get of, the, and, if, arver, all right? And that's the only thing on the page and you're like, okay, that's not good. You then put in a FOIA for that. And that's a Freedom of Information Act request, which goes to, like, if you're at the presidential library, does it go to the presidential library or does it go to the agency that would have created that document? Because I'm assuming that what's in the presidential papers are a bunch of the little, Augie helped us understand that there are 10,484 million offices in the executive office of the president, right? Like there's, everything is under that office. So like, do they have different rules within that? Or is that one rule and does it come out of the library or does it come out of an agency?
The answer is actually less convoluted.
Oh, good. Because the question was terrible. Sorry.
It's really cool the way that they do this. And part of it tells you something about how transparent a whole lot of people want the United States government to be. So what they do is, let's say someone does a FOIA, or let's say I do a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request on Joe Biden's national security, I forget what he's calling them now, his memorandum on how to structure the National Security Council. I can't remember if he's National Security Presidential Memorandum or not. Usually Democrats start with P and Republicans start with N, but Biden started his National Security Directive series with N, and that has destroyed my entire brain. I am no longer a function because one of the core belief systems of my life has now been rearranged. But let's say I submitted a FOIA for that. What will happen is you'll have people who are in charge of processing that within the National Security Council staff. And they'll go ahead and they'll find every document related to that. You know, somebody writes a memo that says, I saw the draft change in paragraph 5, change must to shall. That's a memo, that's a record. And each one of those memos, every single piece of paper will be on a list, right? That comes from the FOIA. So they don't necessarily have to let you see the document, but they have to let you know the existence of the document.
Aha.
And then what happens is at the, if the Biden library is a hands-on paper library, there'll be a box that'll say national security directives, and there'll be a folder that'll say, national security presidential memorandum, is it one or I think it's two. And in that folder will be, in theory, everything is declassified will be in that folder, and it might be three or four different folders folder one, folder two, folder three, all of this is big pile. And if anything is not in that folder because it's been exempted from declassification, you know it because there's an exemption sheet in the front that says these are the documents that are missing. So you open up that folder at the library and there's this pink piece of paper and it's, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it's listed, 40 different memos. And one, you'll see the title and there it'll be, like sitting right there. Two, it's not there because it says, exempted, and it tells you why it's exempted. And that's not there. Sometimes it's actually even a pink piece of paper as a placeholder that says, this is where that memo would be, but it's been exempted.
And so, but they still give you the title of that memo.
Most of the time, there are some that don't have the title.
But generally speaking, you would know what you're missing.
Right.
Because I'll give you an example on the domestic side, right? Bill's talking to us about national security memorandums within a particular presidential administration, right? Think, guys, when Brett Kavanaugh was nominated to the Supreme Court, okay? He at one point, worked in the Bush 43 White House, okay? He was the chief, okay? He reported directly to the president. The Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee, made requests for all memorandums that Brett Kavanaugh wrote, when he reported directly to President 43, because they were hoping to find dirt, so that they could go ahead and not confirm him to the Supreme Court. And what came out was, the list that Bill just described, there were certain memos, that were exempted. And the Democrats wanted those memos, right? Because they were like, if they are exempted, there has to be some good stuff in there, right? There has to be some juicy stuff that either embarrasses Kavanaugh or would embarrass Bush 43. But, it had already been decided those were exempt, right? So we knew they existed. We just couldn't read them.
Well, but I would like to ask, though, I'm assuming that a lot of times what's in those memos, in fact, is not particularly juicy, but is protecting...
Oh, yeah.
Something like that, right? Like what you were saying before. That just because things are exempted doesn't mean they're particularly juicy. My guess is that if you got a bunch of memos that had been exempted, you'd fall asleep reading them because they're not actually all that exciting. They're detailed stuff about a particular operation that's, and detailed at the level that unless you're really a policy wonk or an operations wonk, I should say, you wouldn't care. You don't care about the time of day that something arrives at a certain port and then will be picked up by a guy named Bob and taken to another, you don't care about any of that because you don't know any of the players and that kind of level of detail isn't important.
Sometimes the reason the memo is still classified is because of who's in the room, which may be in the memo. Nothing that's said
in the memo is interesting.
It was interesting, but the fact that someone's in the room.
That was the day we all got lunch with Yasser Arafat. Wait, what? Yasser Arafat was in the room? Wait a minute. Wait. That changes everything.
It could be more innocent than that. It's often, I think, the level of staff people, at least national security stuff, the level of staff people who may be in the room.
Colin Powell may have been in the room.
In the room, right. Let me finish up because I think this is the next question, the key question. So something may be exempted from declassification, right? You open up that folder and you look at that pink cover sheet and you're saying, I want to see this memo, right? Well, then you put in a mandatory declassification request. And mandatory meaning I'm a citizen of the United States. I want that memo reviewed to see if it can be declassified. And that's mandatory, that's the law, and it has to be reviewed. So I've done thousands of those. And like over the past 6 or 7 years, like every few, it's coming in like once every 2 months, I'll get an email, or I'll get, depending which library, I'll get an actual surface mail letter that will say, here's the outcome of this particular memo that you asked about. And sometimes it'll be full declassification or declassification with some redaction. In some cases it's been, nope, sorry, not gonna happen.
And so for a whole bunch of librarians around the United States, you're annoying, Bill.
Yes.
Well, okay, wait, but that goes back to my question. So we love all of our patrons. Librarians love all of our patrons.
But you don't love
them. You're not annoyed by them.
We just had another mandatory declassification.
And we love those, and we can't wait to find out what the answer is.
From that political scientist at VCU.
He sure does want this information.
Could he just get his book published so we could like move on?
I'll send him a copy of the book. I'll just
yeah, I'll trade you. But the mandatory declassification request, the librarian isn't determining that. The issuing agency is determining that, right? Or the issuing office, or the office of the president, or someone. Like, it's not me, because I'll be honest with you, if you asked me for something, I'd just hand it over, right? Because I'm
that guy. Is it the National Archives, Bill, that has to makes that decision?
So it's going to go back to the agency that did the classification, and every agency has their own shop that decides those types of things. And there's also, in that executive order, they created a national, I can't remember the exact name of it, National Declassification Center. That's the name. I'm blowing all my names today. All the Biden's, for instance, memos are National Security Memorandum. But there actually was created an actual center to try to streamline the process so that individual agencies can't just sort of bury requests.
Which I'm going to say, my experience with FOIAs is that almost always the first answer is no. Mm-hmm. Like they lead with no, and then you kind of have to shove them to yes, because either they're respecting the original person who said classify this, right, for whatever reason, or they've got so many requests that they're just buried, and they want to weed out the people who are casually asking versus the people who are really doing research and really want to know. Right. I'm assuming that there's some of that, and I don't like that gatekeeping aspect, but I also understand that for some of the materials in there, especially when human sources could be affected / destroyed because of that, that you would definitely want to make sure that those people were protected. Mm-hmm. Has your experience been, okay, in your mandatory declassification requests, are you mostly winning or mostly losing? Or are you 50-50 at this point?
Well, what I've got is with the, let me back over a second. You issue the mandatory declassification request. You ask for it. So then you say to people, when will I get an answer about this?
And they say, what's your life expectancy again?
yeah, basically. So, you know, if I've submitted a few thousand, in particular to Carter and Reagan, where I was doing some research, I say I've gotten maybe 30.
Wow.
At this point. And I'd say we're into 4 or 5 years into some of this stuff. And part of that actually is cutting back on the resources to do declassification. Right? That's one.
Oh, well, if you're going to trim, I guess. Okay.
One way to slow the whole thing down is to say we're going to have fewer people dealing with this. And a lot of this stuff has become really, really hard. And I'll connect it to the polarization in the United States, a lot of this stuff has become really hard to do because of the polarization. Because I've looked at the list of FOIA requests, for instance, for the George W. Bush administration. So you can actually go online and see a list of all the FOIA requests. And the number of FOIA requests that are asking for information about Hillary Clinton's dealings with Whitewater and Hillary Clinton's dealings with child sex trafficking and all this stuff, which people have to go and say, that doesn't exist. You know, there's nothing there, but we've got to go and see if there's anything related to that there. So everybody's looking for dirt on everybody else. And that's taken up a huge amount of time for, that could be done for legitimate research.
That's makes me sad, I should say, because I don't, well, and one of those answers should be enough. There is no material here with Hillary Clinton and Whitewater beyond these 10 things that we've given, that we've made publicly available, or at least the titles of publicly available. Quit asking. Like, but I assume that they have to go look each time they get a request. They can't just say, I know that doesn't exist, because something may have been added to the archive, or, right, like they, as a person who does research for people in libraries, I can't just say, oh, somebody asked me about that last year and there wasn't any academic work published on it, because in the meantime, something may have been published, just like in the meantime, yeah, something may have come unclassified. So each time they get that request, they have to go look, even if they're pretty sure it's not going to be in there. So that's super frustrating, because it does take up an enormous amount of resources that that if we stopped being gotcha culture and we stopped being sort of this idea of I want to find dirt on people, mm-hmm, then, I mean, because the reality is, if you've lived more than 10 minutes, there's probably dirt on you in some way.
Well, yeah, and also
depending
too,
on how people view dirt, you know, like...
And look at the impact on a research process, right? You know, Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you're making these requests to declassify material, you're not looking for gotcha material about President Carter or President Reagan, right? You are actually researching a phenomenon, okay, that was important in the history of the United States foreign policy making, right?
Right.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, right?
Yep. You know, boring record of how decisions are made.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're trying to understand how, okay, two different or multiple different presidential administrations were making decisions in one of the, you know, most important elements of international politics in the second half of the 20th century, right? So you're trying to get that information. You're not getting it because you're like, aha,
I'm writing Carter, a gossip tome on,
you know, Carter did this, or aha, the Reagan administration was, you know, chock full of, you know, blah, blah, blahs. No, I mean, you're trying to go ahead and understand a phenomenon, okay? And part of that research process is a curiosity, right?
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to understand how our government works when our government was one of two superpowers in the world.
Well, and we're also trying to compare presidents honestly. Right. Instead of comparing them with surface things, we're actually trying to compare their thought process and their advisory process, because if we can figure out what works best, we can say to presidents, here's how you might want to set things up in the future, depending on what your personality type is or how you learn best or whatever, instead of every president starting more or less from scratch.
Right.
Because the record restarts with each president. Even if that person has been vice president, you were not president. There were things that happened when you were not in the room, and now the learning curve is incredibly steep. And we're asking people to do that, especially in a world that is so interrelated and slow, so globalized. That is an amazingly hard thing to do. And if we could figure out, hey, it looks like this is a really good sort of best practice way to kind of approach these things, then we could give a president a leg up on that starting area. And instead, what we've got, because we're polarized, is nobody wants to tell anybody anything about how to do anything right. And that's, yeah. And you know, that's incredibly unfortunate. I think that it's too bad that we don't have, you know how in a lot of committees and organizations, you have a chair and then you have a chair elect and that person like shadows the person doing the job for a year so that they can say, dude, that is a terrible way to go about that. Or that's brilliant. I'm totally going to keep doing it that way because that really works. Like, wouldn't it be neat if we had our elections 1 year backwards so that a president stayed on an extra year and the vice president was actually in that last year was actually the president elect and they got to sit in and learn how to, I mean, if it works for organizations like regular organizations, one would think it would work for the federal government.
Yeah. And in the national security area, it used to work that way in which you had a lot of organizational memory. So you may have had people who worked for instance, I just did research on Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. And you had people who worked for Eisenhower who stayed on and worked for Kennedy. And people worked for Johnson who stayed on and worked for Nixon. And the idea was, you know, you're smart, you're a national security professional. Just because we have a new president in office doesn't mean that U.S. national security interests instantly change. Because right. We weren't thinking along the lines of the polarization and who's my enemy. Because the national security profession, in theory, the people who are sort of in and outers, maybe in academia or think tanks and go back in and work for defense or state or the NSC staff, those people are professionals. Right. That's the thinking about them. So they can work for a Republican or a Democrat.
Yeah. And by the way, this actually ties back to a pretty foundational concept in the modern U.S. administrative state, Nia, that we've talked about in other podcast episodes, which was Woodrow Wilson's idea that you separate politics from administration. Administration right. would be chock full of neutrally competent bureaucrats who could and would be willing to implement whatever policy was created by elected officials. It didn't matter if it was a Democratic president, a Republican president. It didn't matter who was running the State Department, who was the appointed secretary. You know, you had a cadre of, you know, well-trained, well-educated, seasoned bureaucrats who would implement policy, okay? We don't have that anymore, right?
Yeah,
okay? I think presidents come into office, okay? I mean, we saw this with Trump. We're now seeing it with Biden, okay? Right. We're gutting advisory boards every 4 years for the EPA, Homeland Security,
Postmaster General.
And again, guys, you know, Nia, you pointed this out. Bill just mentioned this, right? Doing federal government work is difficult. It's complex. You need that institutional history. Listeners, you know, if you want to know how important transition is, in institutional memory, read Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk, right? Okay. And that's what gets lost. But let's get back to the libraries, okay? And I know we only have a few more minutes, right, Nia? How are we doing on time?
We only have a few more minutes. Okay. Although so if Bill would stay with us with another episode, because there's lots more questions.
Okay, but okay, I got two questions for you, Bill, okay? What in your estimation, share with us your most unusual presidential library experience.
Okay, so I'll tell you about two folders.
Two folders.
two folders, which were hysterical. And I have pictures of them. So I could show them to you.
Okay, I'm going to ask you that question in a little bit, if it's okay.
By the way,
because I want to know the exact process of that.
Oh, okay. By the way, Nia, that's the title for the podcast episode. Two folders. Okay. Bill Newman visiting presidential libraries. Okay.
The first folder was one I found at Eisenhower Library. And it was, I can't remember what box it was in, but actually I can look it up to see what box it was in. But it was declassified material related to national security issues. And it was a folder, and it just had a sticker on the tab inside the folder, and it just said banana. Okay, so I assume it had something to do with the coup in Guatemala. Like 54, which is a banana, and it was empty. So I thought
gave
that
you
was
an
great.
Empty folder.
Empty, right?
Did they know it was empty, or did you say, has this been stolen?
Oh, no, that just means that when you've got those documents, for instance, you may have an entire folder which has been exempted, but the folder is still inside the box. So if you do a FOIA request, and they will put together boxes of all these documents, and if none of this stuff is declassified, and I've done this before, where I've asked for 18 boxes worth of information, and I will get 18 boxes filled with empty folders. Hundreds of empty folders, and you'll just go through them, because maybe there's some document in
wow.
there. They've already blown my 1 o'clock pull from the archives, so they can't give me another 18 boxes until 3 o'clock, so I'm stuck with these 18 boxes, so you just go through them.
Okay.
And you look at the titles, and actually the titles tell you something, because now you know, okay, I know what's going to be here, you know,
someday,
X many years down the line. And the other folder was from the Carter administration, and it was a folder related to the Paperwork Reduction Act.
That is Augie's favorite act
right?
ever. He can work it into an episode. You have just made his day.
Oh my goodness. That
into an episode. Oh. He is a happy, happy man.
I got to send you the picture, because it was this giant folder overstuffed with paper that was disorganized, and none of it was lined up, and it was just all sticking out all over the box. Somebody did this on purpose. Come on.
Oh yeah.
That's the federal government. Okay.
That's ours.
Right?
Can we actually have that picture for the guide? Would you be willing to let us put that up on the guide?
Oh, sure.
Because that's hilarious. Well, I've got that. Paperwork reduction. See this folder.
Chock full of disorganized, okay, paper. About the awesome. Paperwork Reduction Act. Oh my goodness.
It's just lined up nice and neat. So, you know, it's orderly, and you open up the folder and it's all, you know, everything's lined up. But this one was just a disaster.
Oh, that had to be the librarian having a good time, don't you think? Just for a minute, they're like, okay, this is pretty funny. Let me do it in this way. I'm not going to destroy anything or move anything, but I am going to make it a little bit messy for him.
Oh, that's great. You just made my day, Bill.
That is a wonderful way to end this episode. Thank you. Cause that's marvelous. Would you be willing to stay with us for another episode?
Oh yeah, sure.
Wonderful. Okay. Well then we'll wrap up this one, and we'll be back next week with our second episode. Thanks everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.